Welcome back to the Fifth Estate from the Wheeler Center. In this episode, Women's Work, we're joined by American author and war correspondent Megan K. Stack. At the 2019 Bendigo Writers Festival, she spoke with our host Sally Warhaft about the ethics, unexpected emotional shifts, and negotiations of the household as a workplace.
It's a pleasure, an absolute pleasure today to have Megan Stack here with us. She is the author of an acclaimed book, Every Man in This Village is a Liar, her first book, and of course a renowned journalist. Megan worked as a bureau chief in Moscow for the LA Times, but she's here to talk about her latest book, her memoir called Women's Work, and it's a thrill to have her. So please welcome Megan Stack. I was talking to Megan about a book that she hasn't actually read, but some of you might have heard of Lisa Tadeo's Three Women. It's a book about three American women where there's a deep dive, a deep investigation into the intimacies of their lives. And I read it just by chance after I'd read your book, which also looks very deeply at the lives of three women. And I thought, even though this other book had received rave reviews, I really, really disliked it. I felt like she'd thrown these women up for judgment from the reader. When I read your book, I felt something very, very different, and that was that you'd put yourself up on a platter. It was yourself that you'd exposed. So many women have written books, particularly journalists, when they have babies, about the trials of motherhood, but you did something really different in exposing yourself in this relationship between domestic workers in countries, well, specifically China and India. Is that how you feel? Is that what you feel you did too in writing this?
Well, I really, to me, it's the story of four women, and one of them is me. So it was kind of, I wanted to explore the ways in which my own sort of trajectory in my early years as a working mother had been facilitated and also sort of entangled with the trajectories of these other working mothers who were migrant workers who had left their own children behind in villages and come to the cities to work in order to support their children. And I wanted to get into all of the problems and the complexities and the sort of, evasions that exist inside of those relationships. And just, you know, I not necessarily as an indictment of paid domestic labor, but also not as a justification of it. I just wanted to kind of, I felt like when I experienced the relationships, it didn't really correspond to anything that I had seen or read about domestic labor. I feel like the usual narratives didn't seem familiar to the experience that I was having. And so that kind of, you know, in a journalistic way, I felt really pushed to kind of get into it and explore it. Yeah.
So, of course, you left a fantastic job as a foreign correspondent to go to China to have your first child and then to India, where you had your second child, while your husband, Tom, continued to do his glamorous reporting. I've got just a couple of little quotes about becoming a mother. Isn't every woman shocked by her first baby? The love he provoked, fierce and searing, a natural disaster. Which I have 4.5-year-old twins, so that natural disaster is still quite close to my memory. I worshipped the nurses. I never wanted to leave them. Whenever I wanted to feed the baby, I pushed the button by my bed and somebody appeared to smile and coo and arrange us into a nativity sculpture. I loved the button that summoned them. that button. And then, of course, you just sent home. So tell us a little bit about the sort of the expat situation that you were in. I mean, you're obviously, you're in China, you have no family other than your husband, so, and you leave that button behind.
Yeah, well, I had thought, you know, when I was having the baby, my mother said, I'm going to come and help you. And I was so sort of delusional about what it entailed to have a baby that I was sort of saying to her, like, no, you know, don't come. Because I had this image that somehow, you know, my husband and baby and I were going to be, like, in this diaper commercial with, like, sun, you know, pouring through the window and, like, the three of us on a spotless bed having these bonding experiences. And I just had no idea how crazy it was going to be. I mean, in some ways that was just exacerbated by the particular details of my own birth experience. I had a very bad delivery. It was, you know, 48 hours of labor followed by an emergency C-section, and I didn't sleep for 3 days, and then I suddenly had a newborn to take care of, so I kind of went into it with my tank pretty empty.
And then didn't sleep for...
Right,
six
and
months.
I didn't sleep for like a year. Mm. But when the baby was born, I literally hadn't slept an hour in like 3 days. And so that's just a terrible way to go into your sort of life as a new mother who's going to be breastfeeding. And then we went home, and I had underestimated everything about my own sort of emotional response and just the sort of, I mean, nobody really, I guess I shouldn't say nobody tells you, because I have a theory that people do tell you, but we all kind of hear what we want to hear, because you will talk to women who say, no one told me it was going to be so difficult. And you also talk to women who say, everyone told me it was going to be so horrible, and they never mention all the love and the amazing things about having a baby. And I think we all kind of hear different things and filter what we want to filter. But I didn't realize that I would be just like biologically wrecked by the experience of giving birth, that I would be, you know, there's like a few weeks with both the babies where I just felt very strange and jagged, and I would cry very easily, and you just feel like you're in this kind, I was in this very bad sort of raw emotional state. And I think a lot of women are in that. I think that's very normal. I think it's some kind of hormonal readjustment or something, but yeah. And so we went home. My mom did come, thank God, of course. So as soon as I had the baby, I was like, where's my mother? I need my mother. And she was coming, because I guess she was overriding my sort of silly requests. So it was me, and my husband had a bit of leave from work, and my mom, and that was all kind of working. We were sort of getting along. I mean, you use the word expat. I have to say here, I don't usually use that word, because I feel like it's been criticized a lot in recent years. Like on, you know, that only white people are expats. I don't think that's totally true, but I think there's enough truth in that critique that I feel a bit awkward sometimes saying expat. Like, I never say I'm an expat. I always just say I'm a foreigner, because I'm not from here. You know, I'm a foreigner. So if you hear me talking about foreigners, that's what I'm talking about. Even though, I mean, it's expatriate is technically correct. It literally means a person outside of their country, but it's come under a lot of critique. So I think there's something to it. Anyway. We had been living in China, and I had gone to China as a foreign correspondent. I had gone there with the LA Times. I had started language training, and I had started working, and I had finally gotten pregnant, which I had wanted to do for some time. And my first book had come out, and I was starting my second book, and I just thought, this is impossible. I can't, you know, my job was too much. I couldn't continue the job, plus the book, plus the baby. So I quit the job, but I didn't think I was sort of, you know, going home to take care of the baby. I thought I was going home to write the book, and that I would just sort of incidentally and easily take care of the baby in the meantime, and it was all going to be really simple. And so, of course, I ended up feeling very overwhelmed. My mom went back to the U.S., and Tom went back to work, and it was me and sleepless and the baby crying all the time and all of that, you know, that whole scene that you get into with the newborn. And so... All through my pregnancy, people had been saying to me, around me, you're so lucky that you're pregnant in China because help is affordable here. Like, I kept hearing that phrase. And then, you know, I finally understood, like, yes, this is actually, like, I have a relative advantage here. Like, there's something I can do to relieve the craziness of this. So that was when we hired, for the first time, like a full-time domestic worker called an IE in China to come in and just help us with everything, really. I mean, the cooking and the cleaning, and in the beginning, not really too much babysitting, but with the idea that that would gradually, you know, come to be part of the job. And that was a total game changer. I mean, as anybody who will tell you who's had kids and been lucky enough to be able to have somebody help them in the house, it's a huge, like, unspeakable help. It's like night and day.
Well, what's unspeakable too is when they, you know, some, for me it was an auntie, but when they don't show up, but we'll get to that. That filter that you talk about where you, you know, you talked about with a newborn, there's sort of a filter with what you hear about what you might, you know, what might come with having a baby. There's a similar filter, I suppose, with what you'd heard and what you expected in domestic help. So before you first employed the first IE, Xiaoli? Where had your filter sort of rested with what that relationship between you and her would be?
I honestly don't know that I had thought about it that carefully. It was nothing new for us to have part-time cleaning ladies coming through. We'd done that for years. I mean, it wasn't like we'd never hired anyone to come and help in our house before. I don't know that I had a distinct view of what it would be like to have somebody help me take care of the baby. I remember that earlier in our sort of relationship and marriage that my husband and I were both kind of, disdainful at the idea that somebody would get a nanny. I remember we had these conversations where we were both very much like, we're never going to outsource our childcare. Like we, you know, that was like a phrase we had said to each other. And so, it was in some ways, it was just a total departure, but I think, you know, so I didn't really, like when, I remember that when Xiaoli came, I remember I was very adamant, like, I'm going to be taking care of the baby. Like, I still felt like, okay, I'm really only sort of hiring her to take the load of some of the other work that's going on in the house off of us so that Tom can, you know, kind of get some rest and get to work. And I can hopefully start writing soon in between taking care of the baby. So it was very gradual and not very easy for me to move into that, the role of like handing her the baby. That wasn't like, I didn't do that right away. And she kind of had to insist on it at some point. Like she sort of came and said, I'm going to take the baby. Like, can I take the baby? You know, it was kind of like,
the baby.
Basically, because she was kind of looking at me like, you know, she was funny because she really understood what was going on with me, like very clearly. And she just, you know, she was just looking at me like, what are you doing? You know, just like, hand me the baby. What do you think I'm doing here? You know? And so she gradually sort of wore me down and we sort of shifted into this relationship where she would like take, eventually it sort of evolved into, she would kind of be with the baby for like 2 hours a day of kind of unbroken time. And that became sort of my writing time. And that was great. That was great.
And what evolves with Xiaoli and also the two women in India, Pooja and Mary, it is an incredibly complicated emotional as well as economic and all sorts of other areas of relationship. But to start in a way with the emotional, sort of this wrangling. I get this sense throughout the whole work of just push and pull and just trying to absorb what is this relationship, what is going on here. And one of the most confronting and touching moments of your touching because of your awareness of it was when you were going through your photo streams and realized that Xiaoli was excluded from the photos, that what you were sending back to family, what were you were keeping as the filter of your experience living there, she was literally cut out of the picture. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, really, what happened was that it wasn't an issue I had thought about, but I ended up writing, there's a chapter in the book that's almost like, there's a whole section about the issue of photographs and domestic workers and employees and employers, because I realized at some point that there's a huge amount of photographic filtering that goes on both sides. And so I became really interested in what people were taking pictures of and what they were cutting out of the pictures and how everybody in the relationship was kind of depicting their life. But what happened was, it was our first baby's like first birthday, and my husband took all the pictures. And so in all the pictures, it's like me and Xiao Li and the baby, and we don't have any pictures of my husband. And so that really, when I looked at the pictures and realized that had kind of happened without me paying any attention to it, I thought, that's crazy. We don't have a family picture from the first birthday, but actually, this is a very honest depiction of our life for the past year, because the reality is it has been kind of like me and Xiao Li in the house all day, sort of taking care of the baby in tandem while my husband is traveling for work, because he was traveling a huge amount that first year. And so it seemed like I had documented, or we had kind of documented unwittingly, our truth, but maybe not what we actually would want our truth to be. So and then after that, I did find myself sort of deliberately, it wasn't that, I have actually lots of pictures of Xiao Li and of all the women who are in this book, but what I realized is that I found that I didn't want to post them on my social media, and I didn't want to send them to my family or friends, because I felt, you know, it's that same thing, it's like that there's so much kind of embarrassment about I was so embarrassed that we had a nanny. I felt like it was this weird thing, and I just sort of imagined my family, and I have a huge family of cousins, and we're all really close, and I already kind of had this feeling that that my sort of life experiences overseas and so much of what I had done in my life since college, they just, you know, that it's something that they don't really, like, it's not something they've done before, and they don't relate to a lot of my experience, and so I always feel kind of like maybe it's like I'm always looking for these like things that connect me to my family and to my old friends. And so this seemed like another, like I finally had this great experience in common, because my cousins were also kind of all having babies at the same time, and it was something we could all kind of connect about. But then I have this nanny in the middle of it all, which seemed to kind of like throw this, you know, it just throws a wrench into it. So I did realize that I was editing that out of how I was sort of portraying my life, which was interesting to me. And then, because then I noticed that was so common among people who do employ domestic workers. And then I realized later, as I kind of got deeper into this, that many of the women who I knew who were working as domestic workers also had these very curated social media streams, which also did not show their employers, but did sort of portray the houses that they were working in and the sort of the different places they were going in the course of the job. And even sometimes the babies, like the kids will be in the social media stream, because there's sometimes, if the women are sort of open at home about their jobs, which is not always the case, but if their sort of families are aware that they're domestic workers, sometimes the babies will be portrayed, but never like the adults, you know, that there's so much, there's such a complicated like dynamic there, and I just think it's not something that anybody involved in it really wants to photograph. And I think that's really interesting, and it's kind of one of these things that makes you think, yeah, there's something wrong here, because no one's really comfortable with it, you know?
That complicated dynamic is just at the heart, I think, of this, of what you're doing in this book, and where you describe beautifully, you know, your love for Xiao Li. You say, I think, you know, I love this woman, and that if you and your baby and your husband and Xiao Li were in a boat and one of you had to go, it's just no doubt it would be your husband. and yet at the same time, you then, or, you know, you describe a moment where there's a phone call and her daughter, who's in a faraway village, is terribly sick with a heart condition. She needs to go. She needs to go to the hospital to be with her. Of course, you say go, but followed up with when will you be back? I mean, the honesty, it's why this book works. It's why this book is real. Tell us about that, because it's a dynamic so complicated and so truthful that you can love somebody, but you were her boss in a very subservient relationship.
Of course, and it was sort of like that whole episode of Shaolee's daughter's illness was incredibly difficult because I had a work deadline and I had something I had to finish. And the only way that I really was able to get any significant sort of concentrated writing time was with Shaolee coming to work. Her daughter was sick. It was really scary. And she was sort of going back and forth to her village on the bus. And for her, it was also a very threatening situation because we had actually hired her through an employment agency, which... Later on, I kind of moved away from hiring people from employment agencies, but we didn't really, we had just sort of like hired her in a hurry. So technically she was working for us, but she was really working for this agency. And the agency was, treating any of these women very well. So they had very little kind of wiggle room. So she was worried because she didn't want to lose the job. So her daughter's in the hospital and, she's sort of going back and forth. And of course, we encouraged her to go and be with her daughter. But then once she was gone, it was like this created a lot of trouble because I was getting behind and I wasn't going to meet my deadline. So I was sort of getting into trouble. And then my husband, very logically was saying, well, we should just get somebody else if this isn't going to work out. And then I was very angry. And I said, no, what are you talking about? We can't not only... is that like totally unacceptable to me, but we can't even let the agency know that she's going back to her village or that she's not showing up at work because she's going to get in trouble. And I had this feeling like I can't get her in trouble because she's a mom and I felt like I had this great sense. It was this, at this point we're like way beyond the sort of technical, the idea that there's an employment contract and that there's, sort of set hours and that there's obligations on both sides. So we're like, now we're just in a totally personal realm where I feel like, this is the woman who came in and helped me more than anybody else in the sort of immediate months after the baby was born. And as you said, at that time, I felt much more dependent on her than I did on my husband. And she was just, not through any fault of my husband's, I have to say, but it was just, he just physically wasn't there and couldn't be there. And she was there. And so that bond between us became very strong. And so I felt solidarity with her. I felt loyalty to her. I had this very emotional attachment to her. I have this whole theory. I wrote about this in the book. I've never seen any research on this. I don't know if any has been done, but I feel like something happens with women, who take care of a baby together. Because with both the women who were in my house, with both of my children, when they were first born, we developed this very, very, mostly on my side, to be fair, like I developed a very intense bond with this woman and it felt somehow like this species survival kind of like mechanism of whatever it is that makes us bond with people in order to protect the family unit. And I think it might be because your system kind of thinks it's your mother or your sister, or there's this kind of feeling that like you need this woman. And so you become very attached to this one person. So I had that with Shaolee and we just kind of, we stumbled through it, she was going and coming and we were sort of, periodically having disagreements about how this was kind of, from my husband's point of view, it's like, this is a little crazy because you're going to end up getting in trouble at work. You're going to get way behind on your deadline. And like, what are we even doing? Like, this has all kind of gotten beyond what we meant for it to be. So anyway, and there wasn't really a good resolution or a good answer. Eventually, thank God, her daughter got better and she came back. But then, she got pregnant and then she ended up leaving with the pregnancy all the same.
It's probably no more intimate a bond than you would develop than with the woman that is helping you in the earliest days and months and years of looking after your children in a place that isn't your home. But it's also, these relationships, of course, play out in all sorts of other ways, in cultures. I mean, China and India, two very, very different countries. But in India, which is a country I do know well, I've lived there and worked there, not with children. But I remember doing, I did my PhD field work in Mumbai and I kept a room in a very, very cheap guest house. I mean, this was pretty low rent place, but still had servants. And you know, this is, they were called servants. They were men. They were four men, all from Nepal. Three of them were from Nepal. One was from Tamil Nadu. And again, because it was across sort of 2 years, I came to know them quite well, but you realise how much you don't know. Certainly very dependent on these being people that I saw every day and I trusted. And then I got really sick, really sick. I got dengue fever. And I didn't come out of my room one day. And there'd been some sort of knocking on the door and I couldn't even call out. I was so sick. I was in a sort of fevered delirium. And they ended up just making the decision to come into my room, which was a pretty big decision for men to make with a woman in the room. They took me straight to the best hospital in the city and dropped me there. And then I was in there for 2 weeks. Twice a day brought me food. And they'd never cooked for me. They'd never – that wasn't part of what was done. But they one of the men there was cooked for the others and he would bring me the meals that they were having. And it was it obviously moved me beyond – I had no one else. You know, they – was, you know, sort of the family in that gesture, in that incredible concern that they had. And that when I came back finally, when I was feeling better, I was released from hospital, and two of them, the manager and one of the others, burst into tears when I was deposited back at my room. And I said, why are you crying, you know? And the manager said, Kumar, his name is, he said, we're just so happy you're home. We're just so happy you're okay. And I said, why? You know, what, I mean, you know, what, why are you so moved that, you know, to be crying? And he said, you're the only woman who's ever lived here. Wow. And he said, our wives, they were all married, they all had children, in Nepal, in Tamil Nadu. We see them 1 month a year. That's it. We get 1 month off a year to go home to our villages and see our wives and children. And it opened up a conversation of some very similar issues about men also by the millions in India and China and elsewhere around the world going through this separation from family. And obviously in your book it's yeah. Women.
Well, that was one of the, I mean, that to me is one of the reasons that I wrote the book. I mean, it's not only this kind of, you know, I don't want it to be read as this sort of you know, like kind of rarefied stories of a foreign white lady hiring Asian women to work in her house. The point of the book and the reason that I think it's important and that I wanted to kind of put the stories forward, one of the major things to me is this whole issue of migration and cheap labor that we are all interacting with all over the world. You know, we are living in an age, this is an unprecedented level of migration right now in the world.
It's the story
yes,
of our times
absolutely.
Right now.
100%,
none.
Yes. Mm. And that, you know, so many people, whether it's like internal migration within one country, or whether it's international migration with people having to cross borders, you know, I see it like every week. Just this week, there was a huge story in the U.S. about these poultry workers getting rounded up by ICE in the U.S. in Mississippi and just sent off. And, you know, their children were just left behind like orphans. And now the town is trying to figure out how they can take care of these children who suddenly have no parents. And again, it's just like that's the chicken that you're eating in America. That, and you know, the chicken company is not getting prosecuted. The employers are not getting prosecuted. It always ends up rolling down onto these workers and these people who are, you know, going out you know, going out into places that are not their homes or not their native places, where they do not have support networks, and they have to kind of find their way alone and figure out how to work. And that's like, and when I look around, I just see like everything, like so much of what we have around us, like the furniture and the shoes and the clothes and the things we're eating are created by that process. So I wanted to kind of get into these issues a bit and give people some stories and to kind of, you know, to kind of deepen that discussion a bit. Because what's interesting to me about domestic labor is it's not something that you can do in an abstract way. It's not like buying chicken at the supermarket. It's you have to make these very deep ethical decisions, and you have to find the place that you can sort of live with yourself and live with what you're doing. And every day in your own home, you're operating as an employer with a huge amount of power over other people. And I think in that way, it's sort of it's such a crazy, intense testing ground for people who get involved with it and who are willing to actually question what they're doing and the dynamics that are driving the situation.
Because, of course, it's right there in front of you in your very own home, in the most private of spaces. You make it clear, although you do it, I think, in a sentence or a paragraph, that, of course, every one of us is complicit in this narrative, you know, in what we wear, in what we consume. I mean, I thought you could have built yourself up, if you'd wanted to, a bigger defence on that front for the inevitable people that would go you about being in these relationships. You make it clearly and move on that you can't be part of certainly the wealthier portion of this world as it is now and not be partaking it. And for every single one of us, it becomes a question of how we want to look at that filter.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not interested in sort of defending myself in that sense. I mean, I felt like, you know, I wrote the book. I'm obviously not an idiot, and I understand that I'm just putting myself out there to get, you know, eggs thrown at me because I'm, you know, I'm a white woman living in Asia, hiring poorer women into this, you know, to help me take care of my kids. But, you know, the reality is that dynamic is so common. That model is so often replicated. And it's something that I see a lot of kind of progressive and forward-thinking people back in the U.S. and in Europe are now really advocating for the expansion, like the idea that there should be more nannies and there should be more women coming in. And, you know, that's sort of the way forward for upper middle class and middle class women in the West and in the developed world, which I don't, you know, I think if that's something we want to do, I think we should have honest accounting of what that entails and what you're actually talking about. And, you know, then you'll have to look at domestic labor as an industry that is desperately in need of regulation. So let's have that conversation. And, you know, I think it's important to be, I feel like we're living in this era right now. I feel like one of our defining features is this disingenuousness, where we all have these ideas and yet we are often very unwilling to acknowledge who we actually are in this scheme of things and what we're actually doing. And so I just, you know, like as a beginning point, let's at least be really direct. I mean, I would say about what we're, you know, what are the choices that you're making and how are you justifying those choices and what, you know, what are the alternatives? Is there an alternative? Maybe you don't really have an alternative. So that's what you're doing. I mean, you know, just say it.
It feels to me very much in this moment too. I mean, I agree with everything you've just said, that it's coming home to roost, and that we're seeing in the rise of nationalism and some pretty horrible figures being put in charge of countries, and a sort of sense of the decline of Western liberal democracy as it was hoped for, that there's going to be some pushback, that it could all just blow up in some way, really. But we'll have to wait and see. I'm not feeling too hopeful, I have to say. I mean, it's inequality and a dishonesty, a disingenuousness about relationships that is also a big part of that.
I've thought a lot in my entire career. I think like one of the things I've thought about the most is the concept of borders. I started out working on the U.S.-Mexican border. My first job was at the El Paso Times, and so covering immigration and, you know, thinking about the legality of a border and what does a border actually represent. But I feel like this is, you know, the reason that we're all in Australia and in the U.S. and this sort of whole issue of migration and refugees and immigration is blowing up is because the border is not just sort of a line between two nations. It's also, it's a boundary of, you know, protection and sort of understanding. And it's a very psychological thing. Like it's sort of our emotional comfort zone. It's where we feel like we can control things and where we can stop things that we don't want to have come in or that might make us uncomfortable. And I thought a lot about the sort of border of my house when I was writing this book. And even, you know, that was one of the things that I found really interesting was this aspect of hiring women who were in very precarious situations and had very complicated personal lives. There was domestic violence, there was drug abuse, there was alcohol abuse, there was poverty, you know, just huge, deep issues that they were dealing with. And I think what a lot of employers kind of would like to do is sort of bring these women in as human beings into a family situation and have them cross over that border into your house, but somehow leave all the bad stuff outside. Like you just kind of take your shoes off at the door. You just kind of like, don't bring all that stuff into the house. Just bring this sort of part of yourself in. But because it is a house and because it's not really a job site and it's not, you know, sort of overseen and regulated as a job site in that way, it's not realistic. You end up sort of bringing all of these other things into your house and sort of, and, you know, again, I found it all very powerful as kind of like a metaphor for, you know, in some ways like nationalism and sort of, you know, our identity and what we're trying to control and what we're, you know, how this, we all kind of want to let certain things in because it benefits us, but not accept the entire picture that would come with it realistically. Yeah.
Which every country grapples with in there. I mean, Australia has a peculiar part in this because we're a continent, you know, we're the only one that we don't have, we can't walk across a border as a continent. We're not the only nation. There's New Zealand and a few others as well, but I think it's something that is important in trying to understand an Australian psyche with all of this, because it's, for those of you who have, like, it's amazing to walk across a border. You walk from India into Pakistan, or you walk from San Diego into Tijuana in, you know, United States into Mexico.
I have the impression that Australia has a very strong psychological border, and there's like a very like a very like, you know, thick sense of where Australia ends and the rest of the world begins.
I think that's a very astute call for somebody that's been here for only a week or so. Let's talk about what happens when the other two women who we haven't talked about, really, Mary and Pooja in India. When you make a decision after your second child has grown a little to go and track the three women and to interview them, that you've made a decision to write this book. What I noticed is when that part of the book begins, sort of two-thirds or three-quarters of the way into the book, I was reading, thinking, this is like reading another book. And I couldn't quite work it out what it was. And then I realised you were out of the house. Right, that every other part of the book was just locked into that domestic, into those, and there was an intensity in those domestic confines, I suppose. And suddenly you were out, and you know, you were in rickshaws with Pooja in, you know, the mountains, or you know, going to track Xiaoli in China. So, talk to us about how your relationships changed and didn't change then they became interview subjects and were no longer in that paid relationship.
Yeah, that was a really strange, that was a total challenge for me as a sort of an old school journalist background with all of the kind of ethical training that you get and the way you're sort of taught to go about things as a reporter. It was sort of like I was trying to adapt that approach, but and to make it work with women who, with people who had worked in my house. And so I was trying to work out the kind of, you know, I was afraid, when I approached each of them, my fear was that they would feel compelled to agree to be in the book and to let me write about them because of the habitual, like, you know, agreeing to do what I asked them to do because I had been their boss. And so that, for me, was a very sticky thing. And I was very nervous with all three of them, approaching them and explaining that I wanted to write this book and sort of seeking their, you know, just trying to feel them out and sort of to get their blessing. And then, of course, like, not only to write about what had already happened in our house, but to, you know, to tell them that what I really wanted to do was to kind of see their families and villages and kind of, you know, I wanted to get their full story and to sort of put that into the context of the household that we had all kind of coexisted in. But it was different. I mean, there were three different, you know, there were three completely different things that happened. Although, it was very wonderful that all three of them were enthusiastic about the project, not just willing, but they got it and they kind of, they liked it. You know, there was this sense of like, you know, that sort of worked itself out in different ways. But I think, it was a meaningful project for them. They completely understood this idea that we, of the sort of interlocking working mothers and that relationship. And I think the idea that somebody was finally going to, come and look at what was going on with their families and why they had done what they had done and what had pushed them to make those choices and what the cost of that was, which was, you know, as you can imagine, considerable. And the fact that somebody was really going to, take on that whole picture was, I think, somewhat gratifying to these women who, you know, have been treated very badly by the people around them in the course of their existences for, you know, for probably many years. So that was good. But, and again, I mean, there was just, it was three different, you know, personalities, two different cultures, and just different reactions to it. The sort of, for me, the most gratifying and sort of satisfying writing experience of the three was Pooja, because she was always the one who was, you know, she had a secondary level education. She was multilingual. She has a very sophisticated mind. I mean, this woman is extremely brilliant, and she had taught me a lot. Like, she had taught me a lot about Hindu mythology, about Indian cinema, about music. She was very cultured. She was very well-read. She was very thoughtful. She just knew a lot. She taught me a lot about India. I would say more than anybody else I knew in India, I learned from Pooja. So as soon as I sort of broached it with her, she was like right into it. You know, she got it completely, and she just, you know, opened everything. There was like no, you know, she told me everything. She took me to meet everyone. She sort of took me all over her life and kind of, even in a point where I felt she actually made me really nervous, and I never have quite understood this entirely, but she, like, one of the things I discovered when I started reporting on her is that nobody in her village knew that she was working in Delhi as a domestic worker, that she had told everyone she was working in a call center, and only her father and her teenage son, who were the only two who were kind of in on the secret of what her real job was. And yet, she took me to her village, and she wasn't nervous about it. She didn't say, like, okay, so here's the story, you know, and she never sort of explained to me how I was supposed to explain what I was doing there. And she took me all over the village. She introduced me to everybody in town, told everybody that I was writing a book and that she was going to be in the book. And, you know, and it took me also, also some of the most traumatic events in the book were involving Pooja and the domestic violence and alcoholism and all these things. But she, in the meantime, had a new boyfriend, and he was from a sort of an upper middle class family, and his family had no idea she'd been a domestic worker. And she sort of, you know, you read this in the book, she took me to his house and introduced me to his mother, and I was having panic attacks because I was thinking, like, what if they ask me how I know her? What did she tell? You know, I didn't know what the answer was. And she had kind of very quickly sort of rushed me into this house and said, I want you to meet these people. So she was so open, I didn't even really understand what, you know, I almost felt like she was like daring the situation to get exposed because some part of her wanted everybody to find out. Like, I didn't really understand what was going on with her with that. So that was, but she was extremely open, and I felt like she took me through her life in this beautiful way, you know, from like the temple where she worshiped to her family history and this, you know, this beautiful village in Darjeeling. And it was just, you know, and made me understand also just how horrible her situation was that had pushed her to make the choice to come to Delhi. Because I really, when she was working for me, she was so kind of prideful and she was so kind of careful to keep us on some kind of an apparently even ground. You know, there was this sense like she really had concealed from me when I was her employer how desperate the poverty was at home. And had kind of, I think for everyone's comfort, had kind of sort of pretended in a way that her circumstances were more steady than they actually were. And then when we finally sort of got into like the interviews and sort of hearing the whole story, it was, you know, that her family had been so desperately poor after her husband died that, and her in-laws had kind of kicked her out. And she had to go back to her father, who was already struggling with a sick wife and another daughter. And they were desperate. They didn't, you know, they were having trouble feeding themselves. They were, you know, trying to like come up with all these side hustles of like selling vegetables door to door. And it just wasn't enough. They couldn't make it work. And that's when she finally went to Delhi. And that sort of, they talked about the getting this first salary from Delhi, which was like years before she had worked for me. And you know, the salaries were even lower than, I forget what the number was. It was some depressingly small number that she had earned, you know, in a month of domestic work in Delhi. But the way they talked about, the whole family remembered this money arriving, and it was such a big deal. It was like, you know, they all had new clothes for the first time in, you know, years, and it was, they had like a little party, and it was like a, you know, so she had kind of saved her family, not just her son, but her entire family, you know. And, but then it was also, she was very unflinching about talking about the cost of her, of the, all of this to her son, and how he seemed to be really struggling himself, that he seemed depressed in some ways, that she was, and she was very upset by this sense of alienation in their relationship, and that she had not been able to be with him during these crucial moments of his childhood when, you know, and she would say, I'm sure he needed me. He must have cried for me and I wasn't there. And so, you know, to hear all that and take all of that and to kind of put that into the context of, you know, this is a woman who took care of my baby, you know, and to sort of like try to kind of get your head around all of that was really, was incredible.
The sort of degree of shame that just surrounds women's business with particularly early child rearing, it's just astonishing, isn't it? Where, you know, you're there not wanting your family back home to know that you need help when everybody on earth knows that raising babies is not one person's job and is not a healthy, it's not how human beings are supposed to do this. And the shame, the idea that helping somebody, supporting somebody to look after a new baby is lower in the chain than working in a call centre. So these sort of degrees of shame around women's business. Did you, when you came out the other end of this, you know, intense investigation and into their lives, and really putting it at the forefront of your thinking, did you land anywhere differently in your sense of how you went about doing this from then on, your relationships in the future?
Well, you know, I've said this before. I think the funny thing is with this whole process of like picking this apart and putting it back together again and kind of going into all the different aspects of it, I have to say my feeling is in the end, I would do it again. Like I would hire these women again. I might, you know, there might be some minor, you know, differences in, I don't know what, but I mean, I'm not sure I would like repeat every single thing. And I certainly made mistakes along the way as, you know, documented in that book. But, you know, I didn't write this book to kind of, you know, condemn anybody. I think that it, for me in those, in the, you know, at the time of, you know, in the time that it took place, being in China, being in India, and not having really a community or family around me at the time, and you know, it was the best alternative for me, because I did think it was important to try to keep working and to sustain my career, not only for me but because of my children. I want both me and my husband to have viable, you know, careers that can, you know, support them in case something happens to one of us. You know, it's like, this is our family. It's, you know, I feel, you know, personally, I feel very called to work. My work is very important to me, and I want to do it. I'm also called to be with my kids. And, you know, this was the best alternative that was available. It just was. You know, in a better world, it wouldn't be, but the truth is it was. And, I think that all of the women in this book would say the same. It wasn't a great thing that they did. They didn't, you know, there were so many downsides for them and for their families, but the money was real and the stability that came with it was real. And again, in a perfect world, they would have better choices. But given the choices they had, I think this is the best it could be. But what I will say, I couldn't resolve all of it. I kind of worked my way through all of it. But the first thing that I noticed that was wrong with the relationship was also the last thing that I still feel is wrong with the relationship and that I can't really get peace with. And that is just, again, the incredible damage, which I feel is downplayed and ignored in a kind of a, there's almost like, it's almost like people who are in comfortable positions want to pretend that people who are in uncomfortable positions do not have the same emotional range as they do. And I feel like there's just an unwillingness to really confront the unbelievable sort of family and psychic and emotional damage that comes with having to leave your children behind. I think, you know, and in China, it's sort of institutionally, you know, there's no way not to do that because they have this whole system of school vouchers. Like, you can only go to school in the district where you were born, or where your family is from. It's not even where you're born. You could be born in Beijing. It's not enough. You have to be like tracing your family lineage, and that's where you can go to school. It's called the Huku system. And, so these, you know, there's no choice. If you want to go to some place where you can work and earn enough money to support the kids, they're not going to be able to come with you. They can't go to school there. So, you know, that's like the system and the reality that is underneath all of these kind of Chinese goods that we're all buying.
Is it the mail line?
I forget the answer to that question. But it's you have to have family lineage. I would assume it probably is, but because I don't know that 100%, I won't say yes. But I would think yes, that it probably is.
But you're locked into that.
Your kids have to go to school where your family is. You can't get permission to go to school someplace else, which is incredible when you consider what a huge percentage of Chinese parents are having to work someplace else. And that's why they say that there is a generation of left behind children, they're called. And so that's, you know, all of that is like, that's very difficult to sort of get your head around that. And I think, you know, it's real. Like, that there is real deep, unfixable, unresolvable damage in all of those families. So, and you know, that's what it is.
Our time has gone so fast, and we'll have to wrap it up there. But we're really grateful. I'm so thrilled to have been able to have this conversation about something that I've always wanted this book to be written, and you've done it. So that's fantastic. Congratulations. And thank you for coming to Australia, and particularly coming to the Bendigo Writers Festival to talk with us today. Megan Stack.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Sally Warhaft and Megan K. Stack, recorded live at Bendigo Writers Festival on the 11th of August, 2019. This series comes to you via the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com, and until next time, take care.